Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're using more emojis and slang terms than ever before, but the grammar basics haven't changed. Mignon Fogarty is here to help. She is the founder of the Quick and Dirty Tips Network and author of several grammar books and host of the Grammar Girl podcast. Mignon joins us by phone. Welcome back.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Listeners want to know what your burning grammar question is. You can ask Mignon to help settle some longstanding grammatical feuds, if those exist. We know they do. Give us a call or send an email. Call us at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. In our current political climate, we hear a lot about information that's false or fake, as some people like to say, fake news. But two words we're hearing more of is misinformation and disinformation. What's the difference between mis and dis when it comes to information?
Well, they are both negative prefixes, but the words have come to mean different things. So misinformation isn't malicious. It's, you know, information that's not correct, that's inaccurate, but it's given without malice. So the mis prefix there is similar to how you'd think of it in the term misspeak. You know, if you accidentally said something wrong, you might say, I misspoke.
Mm-hmm.
So if someone is giving misinformation, it's wrong, but they aren't doing it maliciously.
Mm-hmm.
I was really surprised to learn that the word disinformation comes to English through Russian. It actually comes from Russian, and it means, it essentially means government propaganda. It's inaccurate information that's given intentionally, often by a government, to try to, you know, influence people. And there's this hilarious story about carrots in World War II in a disinformation campaign. So the British, during World War II, the British developed a new type of radar, and the Germans noticed that somehow suddenly the British were getting really good at detecting airplanes in the dark, and the British didn't want them to know they had this new technology. So they started circulating disinformation that they were feeding their pilots massive amounts of carrots to improve their night vision.
Is that how that happened?
Yeah. And it turns out, it led to this belief that eating carrots can improve your eyesight, which actually isn't true unless you're vitamin A deficient. If you're vitamin A deficient and you eat carrots, it will improve your eyesight. But if you're, you know, a normal, healthy person with normal eyesight, eating lots of carrots won't improve your vision. But the British circulated this disinformation during World War II, and researchers do believe that people in Britain and maybe Germany actually did start eating more carrots because they thought they were good for their eyes because of this disinformation. So I thought that was just hilarious.
Also, two words that are getting used a lot that maybe people don't see the difference: internment and internment. Internment's been brought up a lot lately because of Japanese internment during World War II, and whether or not current policies with ICE in the United States are reflecting or replicating that.
Right. So they sound so similar, those two words, internment and internment. And they're both bad things, mm-hmm. or negative things,
mm-hmm.
but they actually have different roots. So,
and I was surprised at that.
I was too, actually. So, because they sound so alike, you'd think they might come from the same origin. But
mm-hmm.
Interment, when you're interred, that's when you're buried after you die. And it comes from the Latin for in the earth. So in terra. So it's the same terra that gives us, you know, terrarium and terrain. It all comes back to earth. So interment is being put in the earth. And internment is, you know, more like the phrase we think of as internment camps, like what was, you know, what we happened to Japanese American citizens, again, in World War II. I guess we're in World War II today. and I have had people send me pictures of obituaries that use internment instead of interment.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a commonly confused term in, you know, obituaries and things like that. So
is it inaccurate to say somebody was interred in a mausoleum then, if they're not buried in the ground, that their ashes were interred in a vault?
Well, technically, given the origin, it seems like that would be incorrect. But sometimes in English, words evolve to take on meanings that aren't literally related to the origin.
Yeah.
So I don't know off the top of my head whether you could say, you know, ashes in a mausoleum, someone was interred. But it seems to me like I've heard it used that way. So I wouldn't be surprised.
This is an interesting question that I've wondered about. Words like that we use, it's the way we pronounce words like kinda, wanna, gonna, and you kind of see that, you kind of see that, and I'm gonna do this, in dialogue, in written dialogue, you see it because you want to reflect how people are actually speaking, but are they real words?
Well, they are. They are real words. You know, and it's funny because you just noticed, and I noticed too, when I'm doing my podcast, even if I have written out in front of me, I'm going to go to the store, I will often say, I'm gonna go to the store. It's just how native English speakers tend to talk. But when we're writing, we don't write it that way. And typically, you shouldn't write it that way in, you know, a magazine article, a newspaper article, something for work. If you're writing fiction, it's more acceptable to write words like wanna and kinda that reflect how people actually speak because, you know, it sounds more authentic and people do recognize those words when they're reading. They don't seem, you know, wrong, but they're in writing, especially, they're considered very informal. You know, I would imagine, you know, people giving formal talk, you know, a TED talk or a corporate talk would still say wanna and gonna in their speech without even realizing they're doing it. But I bet the published transcript or ahead of time script of those speeches has the words written out want to or going to just because it's how we write as opposed to how we speak.
I meant to look it up before I talked to you today, but are they words that you would find in the dictionary?
Some are and some aren't. So I don't remember which are which, but you know, if you look up kinda, wanna, gooda, gonna, have to,
shoulda,
you know, some are. I'm pretty sure shoulda isn't included, but they come with different qualifiers. So some will be listed as informal. Some might be listed as slang. Some might not be listed at all. And I think it varies from dictionary to dictionary, too. So they're sort of in this gray area of acceptability.
Are slang and slang pronunciations a big thing in dictionaries now?
Well, dictionaries often include slang. So their goal, a dictionary doesn't reflect how language should be used properly. It reflects how language is actually used by people. Because dictionaries, you know, if you see a word, they want you to be able to go to their dictionary and look it up and see what it means. So if a word has been used, especially in print, you know, a lot, it will show up in a dictionary even if it's slang. Now, you know, some dictionaries, it takes a while, so they need to find it in print multiple times and have a sense usually that it's going to continue to be used at least for a while. So, you know, a word can go into the dictionary slowly or quickly. You know, I think staycation is an example of a word that went into the dictionary pretty quickly after it started being used because, you know, people were using it a lot, and you could kind of sense that it would continue. It had staying power. Vacation has staying power. And so it went into the dictionary pretty quickly. You know, if there is a slang term that isn't used a lot in print and has a sense of being very fleeting, it might not make it into the dictionary because, you know, it just doesn't seem like it needs to be there because people won't be encountering it very much in the future.
I wonder if yada, yada, yada is in the dictionary.
Oh, my gosh, that's a great question. I don't know.
Yeah.
I bet it is.
Well, we'll have to have somebody check while when we take a break. In the meantime, Josh in Columbus, you're on the air with Mignon Fogarty. Hi, Josh.
Hi. I'm glad I caught this segment because my wife and I were actually having a discussion yesterday about a possessive noun that ends in S. And then you put an apostrophe, no second S. Do you pronounce the second S or you do not pronounce the second S?
Can you give us an example?
Okay, like Lewis. I'm going to Lewis's house or I'm going to Lewis's house.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I know what you mean. So for names like that, it's actually a style choice. So the Chicago Manual of Style would have you put an apostrophe S at the end of Lewis to make it possessive. And the AP style book would just put an apostrophe at the end. So with names in particular, how you write it depends on which style you follow. And then I would pronounce it, regardless of how I wrote it, I would pronounce it Lewis's house. But I'm not sure if there's a hard and fast rule. I mean, I think it's... Hello?
Yep. You're there, Mignon? Oh, I guess they hung up. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think it's more, you know, I would say Charles's castle, Lewis's house. Stuart, okay. Not that ends with a T. but I think I tend, just going on what sounds natural to me, I think I tend to pronounce the extra S, but I'm not aware of a hard and fast rule.
All right. Thanks for that call. Anybody else out there? 614-292-8513. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. If you have a pet peeve, if you have a question about grammar or word use or pronunciation, give us a call. My guest is Mignon Fogarty. She's a author of many books on grammar and word usage and host of the Grammar Girl podcast. Here in the Midwest, this is always an issue that comes up. Maybe we can beat this one to the punch. The people who say, my car needs washed instead of my car needs to be washed. And then we say it's in the Midwest, but I really never started hearing it until I moved to Ohio. So.
Right. Well, Ohio is included in the region that linguists call the North Midland region. And that needs washed construction, it's sort of its epicenter is Pittsburgh.
Okay.
Ohio is definitely included in the region where people say my car needs washed instead of my car needs to be washed.
Uh-huh.
And it comes with other things too, like the lawn needs mowed, the dog wants walked. It's quite common. And, you know, whenever I come on your show, people who have moved to Ohio always call in and ask about it. Why do my neighbors say things this way? I don't understand. So I can tell you I can't tell you why, but I can tell you where it comes from.
Yeah.
So it's because people who are called the Scotch-Irish. So those are people who are originally from Scotland, but then lived in the Ulster region of Northern Ireland for a while. Those Scots-Irish are a large part of the people who settled in the Ohio area. And that construction is common in Scotland, in those people with the Scots-Irish heritage. They brought it with them when they came to America. So it's because of the settlers in the region, they brought that sort of language quirk with them, and then it survives today in Ohio. And there are other interesting North Midland dialect features. For example, I wonder if any of your listeners say or have heard someone use what's called the positive anymore. That's when you say something like, there's a Starbucks on every corner anymore.
Okay.
So it's using anymore in a way that people in the rest of the country would use nowadays.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. So I might say there's a Starbucks on every corner nowadays. But I my understanding is that people in Ohio and Pittsburgh might instead say there's a Starbucks on every corner anymore. And so I'm really curious if your listeners say that or have heard that.
I have heard that, but I've only been here 30 years. So maybe someone else with a longer term memory and experience can chime in here. The number is 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guest is Mignon Fogarty, author of many books on grammar and word usage and host of the Grammar Girl podcast. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Hundreds of new words are added to the dictionary every year. We're talking about from whence they came. I hope I put that properly. So with us by phone is author and host of the Grammar Girl podcast, Mignon Fogarty. Mignon, thanks again for joining us.
Sure, you bet. And during the break, I looked up yada, 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 yada.
Yeah.
And Merriam-Webster does include it. They have yada, yada. And then a variant is yada, yada, yada. Which is funny. And also, for some reason, I thought it was Yiddish, but it's not. Merriam-Webster says it comes ultimately from British dialect of yadder, yadder, which meant to chatter. So,
really?
There you go.
I thought you were going to say Seinfeld. So
yeah, that's what I think of, too. Apparently not. British dialect.
Gosh. When, you know, this is something you wanted to talk about. When someone is helping out or someone's done a service, you say, oh, you're a real trooper. And most people spell it with two O's, trooper. And it's not actually where that comes from, is it?
No, I thought this was very interesting, too. So the original phrase was a real trooper, T-R-O-U-P-E-R. And a trooper spelled that way is an actor. And so originally, someone who was a real trooper was an actor who maybe was sick or injured and powered through and you know, the show must go on, went on stage still despite adversity. So that's the origin of the phrase, a real trooper. And so the correct original spelling is with a U, T-R-O-U-P-E-R. But, you know, if you look in databases, the trooper spelling with two O's is becoming much more common just because I think it's a word people are more familiar with, spelled like, you know, a state trooper. And, you know, as I talked about in my TEDx talk, that's how language changes. You know, people vote with the way they write, with their usage. And if lots and lots of people start writing it the, quote, wrong way, eventually it will become accepted with that, quote, wrong spelling. So this is an interesting phrase that's sort of in the middle of undergoing language change. You know, the origin is interesting because it comes from acting, and you can remember that it's now spelled trooper with a U because of an actor in a troop. But I think ultimately the double O spelling, you know, in 10 or 20 years will probably win in the voting and be the standard. But today it's trooper with a U.
I like the origin. I think it's interesting. It's more interesting. Let's see.
Yeah, I agree.
Judy in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Judy.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I have a question about the use of the word "duh." I have noticed that my Canadian friends, if they're talking about someone that's going to the hospital, they will say they're going to hospital. Or, for example, they also say they're going to university, not like we would say the university. And I was just wondering how that evolved.
Yeah, I don't know exactly how it evolved. I know it's one of the common differences people bring up between British English and American English, and apparently Canadian English, too. We have some instances in American English where we use both. So, you know, you might say on Sunday, I'm going to church. But then if you're on Wednesday, you're delivering a pie, you might say I'm going to the church before I go to the store. So we do have instances where, you know, going to church is more like attending the service or participating in something there. And going to the church is like visiting the structure. Mm-hmm. So we do have instances like that in American English, but it is a well-known difference between British and American English. And unfortunately, I can't tell you why.
It's interesting. You're right. I mean, I hadn't thought about it. Going to church, going to university, going to hospital. Huh. Interesting. Judy, thanks for that call. Let's see. Gary in Dublin, you're on the air. Hi, Gary.
Hi, yes. I had a question. I actually did hear a positive use of the term these days, you know, instead of saying these days, I did hear the other positive use. Anyway,
yeah.
I have a question for you.
Anymore.
Anymore, yeah. I did hear that. My friend of mine used to say it, and he had no idea where he got it from, and I couldn't figure it out and never heard anyone bring it up again. Anyway, I was more interested in the expression theirs. I hear a lot of people around here say the word there's two or there's three, and it seems to me it should say there are two or there are three, and I don't understand what the real rule is, because I see it sometimes even in print, and I just don't know what it is.
I do that, and that bothers me, but I do it. There's five people coming today. Yeah.
Yeah, I did that too. When I first started my podcast, you know, more than 10 years ago, I did that, and listeners called me on it. I got complaints, and I changed my ways. There are is the way it should be said. So you should say there are five firefighters on the scene, for example. But there are is actually just really hard to say. Mm-hmm. It doesn't like roll off the tongue very easily. And theirs is easy to say. And so I think that's one reason people do it, is just the ease of saying the sound. Also, you know, it could be that people are thinking of, you know, the five firefighters as a collective, as sort of one group of things. So you could imagine in people's minds, as they're constructing a sentence, you know, on the fly in speech, that the way they're thinking of a group of people instead of five individual people could also be influencing them to say theirs instead of there are. But you're absolutely correct that the right way, the proper grammatical way to say it is there are five or there are three of something. Even if it's plural, you should use are.
As a writer, I try to avoid there to start a sentence anyway. So maybe say five people are visiting. Five people will visit, that kind of a thing. But it would be five people are.
Right, absolutely. And that's really common writing advice, to avoid starting sentences with there are and it was.
It's passive. It's passive writing, right?
Yeah, although if you look at classic literature, you know, there are examples where that is, you know, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. Mm-hmm. It's a famous sentence from literature that starts that way. So mm-hmm. It's not always bad.
Tale of Two Cities, right? Let's see. Steve in Westerville. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi, Ann. Love the show. I think you kind of touched on this earlier. Why people find it necessary to start a sentence with so, the word so. So it's a nice day. So I went to the supermarket yesterday. So how do you like Trump? So why is it necessary to start a sentence with so?
And Steve, I have to tell you that I'm noticing it more and more and more, and I hear it a lot on radio interviews. Madame Fogarty?
Yeah, I do it. I know I do it. when I listen back to myself. So, yeah, I just did it.
Yeah.
A lot of people will say that it's condescending, and I know that when I'm using it, I'm not being condescending, or I'm not intending to be condescending. For me, it's a way of gathering my thoughts, maybe, you know, introducing a pause in the sentence, or indicating that what I'm saying is sort of a continuation of what I said before, you know, maybe acknowledging that you asked a question about a topic and then I'm continuing that topic. So it does have, let's do it again. Mm-hmm. It does have, linguists will say it has grammatical purposes too. I think sometimes it's called a discourse marker, but I know a lot of people find it annoying. I do.
I used to think it was sort of the new like that thought gathering.
Yeah, it definitely. Yeah. In some uses, for sure, it definitely can be.
So, Steve, I hope it doesn't irritate you too much. Thanks for your call. If you have a question or comment for my guest, Mignon Fogarty, author of many grammar books, word usage books, and also host of the Grammar Girl podcast, you give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We have an email from Joan. She says, this goes along with talking about misinformation and disinformation. Could you talk about the difference between uninterested and disinterested? I thought that in this context, dis meant impartiality and un meant a lack. But I often hear folks speak of being disinterested when they mean they don't care one way or the other.
Yeah, no, the person writing the email is absolutely correct. So disinterested does mean impartial. So if you are choosing, let's say, an arbitrator, you have to go to arbitration. You want someone arbitrating who is a disinterested party, who has no interest in the outcome and can therefore be impartial. Uninterested just means you don't care. You don't want an uninterested arbiter because, you know, that person might not pay close enough attention to the details of the matter. So you do want a disinterested person ruling on your case or helping you, you know, in a dispute, but you don't want an uninterested person because that just means the person doesn't care.
And here's an email from a listener, and I hope I'm pronouncing or I can make this clear. They write, "I really enjoy your work," and they're writing that to you, Mignon, and asks, "What are your thoughts on the word yesn't as an alternative to the word no? Yesn't, Y-E-S-N apostrophe T. Have you heard of that?"
I have never heard that.
Me either.
That's fascinating. I'm going to write that down and look it up after the show. Yesn't. That's great.
Yeah, I as an alternative to no, wow, no would be so much simpler.
So was it yesn't with an S or yesn't with a Z?
Y-E-S as in Sam, N apostrophe T.
So essentially like yes, not contracted.
Right.
That's fascinating. I'm going to look into that more.
Yesn't. Yesn't. Yeah. And if anybody out there knows and agrees that this is a thing, from our emailer, give us a call. Let's see. I'm going to turn to Chris in Asheville now. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead.
Here's my problem. The double is. This is a phraseology that's cropped up in all at all educational levels.
Give us an example.
The problem is that, or the thing is that. It's almost as though the preface to the answer would be followed by a colon, and then there's a description of what the what preceded the colon is. It's, for instance, if you were to ask, member of the Judiciary Committee, you know, so what's the likelihood of an impartial arbiter, you know, being nominated to the court? Well, the problem is that the president has to appeal to his base, and I've heard it a million times. This would never survive on the written page.
Well,
no one would ever write it.
Mignon Fogarty?
Yeah, no, it is a common thing, and it's something people notice and complain about, and an error that people make. You know, you might say, the problem is that it's raining. So that's a wrong use of a double is, because you can just say the problem is that it's raining. There are some, unusual, sort of rare sentences where you get two is's next to each other, and it is grammatical. You know, you might say, like, what he is a complete mensch, right? So that's grammatical. That's actually correct. But it's so awkward that I recommend that people rewrite it. It just coincidentally, I happened to be, for strange reason, looking at this entry in the AP style book last night. And that's what I do.
You're kind of weird, Mignon, but go ahead.
I know. And the AP style book recommends putting a comma between the two is's when the sentence is grammatically correct, just to avoid confusion and make it easier to read. So it's not a normal instance when you'd use a comma, but it's sort of there for extra clarity when you have such a weird sentence. But in general, it's almost always better to rewrite your sentence to avoid that double word.
Chris, thanks for the call. Email from Michelle, who asks, is anyways a word? I think no, and correct people to use anyway, but I am curious what your guest thinks. Anyways versus anyway.
Yes, I agree. The correct word is anyway, but a lot of people do say anyways. And, you know, for now, you know, I talked about how people vote with their usage, and it's possible that, you know, anyways seems very common and popular, and so a lot of people are using it. So it may be that in, you know, 20 or 30 years, it becomes acceptable or the standard. But today, right now, anyway, is considered an error. And if you, you know, have a professional editor going through your work, they're going to change anyways to anyway without the S.
Thanks for that email. Now let's turn to Suzanne in Columbus. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi.
Go ahead.
So I have a pet peeve that started about 30 years ago when I started teaching. And it seems to now be standard usage, but it still, you know, puts my teeth on edge. And that is the use of impact as a verb instead of effect.
Yeah, people complain about that a lot. And I think people do, I think people tend to use impact because they don't know whether to use effect with an A or an effect with an E. So they're looking at those two words and, you know, they're thinking, gosh, I don't know which word to use. So I'll use a completely different word, impact. But then that annoys people too, because, you know, impact, a lot of people view that as meaning, you know, as a verb, as implying a collision, you know, a contact. So the car impacted the tree, you know, that's how people tend to think of it. It's very commonly used to mean effect. Mm-hmm. But it's one of those things that's common, but it bothers a lot of people. So I tell people to avoid it if they can.
So in the spirit of that, let's clarify the difference between effect and affect or affect.
Oh, yes. Good point. So it's a very common question. Mm-hmm. So I use a mnemonic, Raven, R-A-V-E-N. Which, because the A-V-E-N part stands for affect, verb, effect, noun. So most of the time, not all the time, but most of the time, affect with an A is a verb, you know, the arrow affected aardvark, and effect with an E is a noun. So you'd say the effect was horrendous. So, and you can, another way to remember when you want to use the noun, effect with an E, the noun, is if you can put the in front of the word, like I just did, the effect was horrendous. I think of the E at the end of the word the as a clue that you need then the verb that starts with the E. So you have those two E's next to each other, the effect. So, you know, those are the two different ways that I remember. And then there are some exceptions, but if you can remember that, Raven, A-V-E-N, affect, verb, effect, noun, you'll get it right like 90% of the time.
Suzanne, thanks a lot for your call. My guest is Mignon Fogarty, author of many books on grammar and word usage. She's also the host of the Grammar Girl podcast, and we'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@WOSU.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. My guest today, Mignon Fogarty. She's author of books about grammar and word usage and host of the Grammar Girl podcast. If you have a question or comment for her, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And remember, Mignon, when I opened the show with... phrase from whence it came.
Mm-hmm.
I of course have an email from Brian saying I got it wrong, and
yeah,
you could have corrected me.
You know me. I don't correct people.
Yeah, I know you're. I know. But Brian had no hesitation, and I don't even know him. Yeah. So I meant I was from where, from whence. Oh, it would be redundant, he says.
Right. The from is implied with whence. It's just sort of included in the meeting.
Gotcha.
Meaning, you know, people commonly, it's a very common mistake. I think you're probably more likely to hear from whence.
Well, I'm pretty
than
common.
Alone.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's okay. Interesting, though, because English has multiple, we've lost all these words for, we have the where of location, the where of origin, where are you from? And the where of destination, where are you going? And we used to have words for all those. So whence is where are you from? And whither was where are you going? But nobody says whither anymore. So that's one of the, you know, sometimes people say, oh, you know, ending a sentence. So it's not wrong to end a sentence with a preposition. But when people think it is, sometimes they'll criticize you for saying, where are you from?
Mm-hmm.
But we used to have the word whence that was like where from, and you say where are you going. I think we used to say something like whither do you go. You
know, whither you go.
Whither you go, but those are all now condensed into one word, the word where,
so, which is boring. I like whither and whence, but I should use them properly. I like whither a lot.
We should bring wither back.
Let's bring wither back. Yeah. Oh boy, we got a bunch of calls have stacked up while we were dealing with my faux pas. Let's see, my grammar faux pas. Karen, and hopefully I said that right. Karen and Hilliard, you're on the air. Hi, Karen.
Hi. Just had a question. My sister and I are both word nerds, and we have had discussions about the usage of orientate, which would be the verbal form of orientation.
Yeah.
And it sounds so awkward, but yet orient seems to imply strictly geography, whereas, you know, orient yourself by your location. But so I went and I got orientated. That sounds awful.
I know what Karen's talking about. What do you say, Mignon?
I do too. So orient and orientate, they're both words. They're both real words. And I know sometimes people think that when there are two words that mean the same thing, you should just choose the shorter one. But they're both actively in use. They're both acceptable English verbs. Yeah.
So the question is, I want to orient myself or do I want to orientate myself?
They're both correct.
Okay.
But orient is... it has sort of taken precedence, especially in American English. I'm looking through some notes here, and it looks like orientate, it also coexists with orient in British English, but I think orientate has more standing in British English than American English. We're more likely to use just orient, and they will use either.
Have you spoken much to British audiences?
I haven't, but... I went to a conference in Cambridge a few years ago, and I met a woman named Bryn Murphy, who is an American linguist who now teaches in Britain. And she has this wonderful blog called Separated by a Common Language.
I interviewed her a few months ago, yeah.
Yeah, she's the best.
Yeah.
So if you're interested in, you know, differences between British and American English, she's your woman.
All right.
And they're fascinating. I love her work.
Karen and Hilliard, thanks for your call. I'm turning now to Andy in Columbus. Hi, Andy. You're on the air.
Hello. I had a coworker once that had an interesting view of the phrase, I could care less. Of course, I told him that I couldn't care less was the correct way of saying it. But he said when he was growing up in the 40s, picture a bunch of 12-year-old boys arguing. One of them might say, I couldn't care less. Well, the next child, in an attempt to better his friend, would answer, well, I could care less. Have you ever heard that explanation before?
I have not heard that explanation. That's interesting. I have heard linguists say they think it originally started, it was used, being used ironically, you know, saying, oh, I could care less, and they were being ironic instead of literal, and then it sort of took on, you know, a meaning where people didn't really think about what it meant. And then I've also heard people say that it's just kind of like with there are, I couldn't care less is harder to say than I could care less, so that people just dropped the NT because it was just harder to say. Those are the two explanations I've heard. I've never heard the one you said, but it does. It's logical. It seems like it makes sense. So it certainly could have happened that way. or happened that way in some instances.
Andy, thanks a lot for that call. We do care. let's see, Judy in Lewis Center. Hi, Judy.
Hi. My question is, the misuse of ideal for idea, and it just makes them tear my neck stand.
Well,
give it
an example in a sentence how they use it improperly. What do you mean?
Well, I think that was a good ideal.
Oh, no.
Instead of saying, I think it was a good idea, and I hear it all the time. But I don't say anything. I just let the hair stand up on the back of my neck.
Have you heard that, Mignon?
It's so interesting that she brought that up, because about 10 years ago, I was on a radio station in Los Angeles, and the host said that he heard that all the time. And I did a blog post about it. And whenever I post it on Facebook or Twitter, all I get are comments of people saying, I've never heard anyone do that.
Yeah.
And then, like, 2 days ago, I got a question. Again, someone saying, I hear people say ideal for idea all the time. And now your caller is saying it. So it's fascinating. Like, it certainly happens and exists. I don't think it's widespread, but maybe it's becoming more common, or maybe it's regional.
It's not a thing.
Most people never heard it.
Yeah.
But it definitely does happen. You're not imagining it.
Wow. Okay. Let's see. That was Judy. Thanks a lot for that call. I'm trying to plow through these real quick because we have, let's see, Margie in Columbus. Hi, Margie.
Hi. I am originally from New York, so it always surprised me when we moved to Columbus and I would hear people say, of a morning or of an evening. You know, I'm going someplace of a morning. I can't stand that.
Mignon, I've heard the phrase too, but it doesn't bother me. But Mignon, what does it mean?
I've never heard that.
Really?
So this is another one.
Oh, you're kidding.
No, I have.
A regionalism. What? So how is it used again?
Well, you know, we'd have somebody come in the office and say, oh, I went such and such a place of a morning.
Oh.
You never heard that in Columbus?
Never.
I hear it all the time.
I have heard it. I wouldn't say it's common, but I have heard it. I bet you Mignon will be checking that baby out. Yeah,
I'm writing it down. I've never heard it, and I've never seen it in a list of North Midland regionalisms. But obviously, I mean, you're there. You know what people are saying. So I'm going to look that up. That's fascinating.
So, Margie, thanks for that call. And I'm going to turn to Jennifer in Westerville. Hi, Jennifer. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a question about punctuation. I learned to type many years ago. I'm 45. I learned to type on like an Underwood typewriter in the fifth grade. And I was always taught two spaces after a period, two spaces.
Oh, boy.
I now have a soon-to-be ninth grader who is insisting to me that his teachers say no. Only one space is necessary. And, of course, he's never seen a typewriter other than in my den, you know.
Yeah,
he's
typing
on Word, you know. And they're telling me, no, one space. So I would like to know what the correct amount of spaces is contemporarily now for, you know, after a period. Because I just think it looks funny.
This is a big change. This is a change, right? Right, Mignon?
Right. Yes, your student's teacher is correct. The current modern standard is one space. But anyone who learned to type on a typewriter uses two spaces. And some people say it has to do with proportional font. Versus, I forget what the word is, but fonts that are the same width. So on a typewriter, all the letters take up the same amount of width on a line. And so it looks better when you type two spaces at the end of a sentence. But then with computer fonts that are proportional, you know, an I is more narrow than an M, the font designers have made the space after the period, they've made spaces like the right width to be between sentences. So I think there's one style guide. It might be MLA that still uses two spaces, but nearly everyone that I'm aware of now uses one space. But it's funny, when I post these articles online, I invariably get,
lots of comments from people saying, I learned two spaces and I am never going to change. I don't care what you say. So if people have passionate feelings about the number of spaces after a period.
Yeah, that is a thing. Yeah. And it's just a habit, too, for me. You know, anyone who's learned on a typewriter, it's a habit thing. It's nothing more than that. Dave in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Dave.
Yes, thank you. When interviewers introduce their guests, the guests normally say, thank you for having me. And my hairs go up because my mother had me. Instead of saying, thank you for inviting me.
Okay.
That's true. Although it's short for thank you for having me on your show.
Yeah. I mean, but it's not, is it incorrect, Mignon, or is it?
I don't think it's incorrect. I mean, I know what you mean about invite being more precise, but, you know, you might say, you know, John had me over to his house Friday night. You know, the word had, it has, I would imagine that if I go into a dictionary, the word had or have probably has 100 different definitions. Mm-hmm. It's one of those really versatile words that can have lots of meanings.
I like those versatile words. Dave, thanks a lot for that call. Now I'm turning to Diane in Dublin. Hi, Diane.
Hello. I work in the technology world, and increasingly over the years, there are people who use the word ask as a noun instead of a verb. And talk about my hairs going up on my neck.
Give us an example of what you mean.
Yeah. So I met with so-and-so, and the ask is that we do this or that.
Okay. But instead of request.
Yes.
Okay.
What's fascinating is that I have not heard this much, except in the last 2 weeks. I've probably gotten 5 or 6 questions about people using ask as a noun, like you're saying, and I have never gotten questions like that before. So it seems like it's increasing in use. I was wondering if maybe...
Sorry, Diane.
I was wondering if a popular TV show was using it or something, some way that lots of people were suddenly hearing it, because I've just had a flurry of questions about that lately.
Interesting.
You know, that English does make new words by turning nouns into verbs and verbs into nouns and all the different transitions. You know, microwave was a noun before it became a verb, when you could microwave your lunch. It's a common way of making new words, but it also tends to annoy people when it happens, when the word is new. So, yeah, it's fascinating. I don't know why there's an increase in ask lately.
Diane, let's see. I'm going to turn to Joanne now in Columbus. Hi, Joanne. We're running out of time. I wanted to squeeze you in, though.
Okay. The thing that makes me yell at the television constantly is when people use less instead of fewer.
Me too.
Talking about professional people, you know, anchors, people, you know, professional people.
Well, let's ask Mignon to tell people what the rule is.
Right.
Yeah.
The general rule is that less is for things you can't count and fewer is for things you can count. So you have less water in the lake, but you're going to bring out fewer glasses of water to the table next time.
Okay. Good to know. And then, Kathy, real quick, you're on the air. Hi, Kathy.
Hi.
We're like 30 seconds.
About people saying, using I when it should be the objective case, and especially like, will you go? If somebody said, do you want to go with me? They'll say me. But if they say, do you want to go with Joe and I? It's always I. And this, again, professional people, newscasters, just makes me bat. I don't know why.
Well, let's see. Let's see what Mignon, we got like 20 seconds.
Sure. You're right. It's a common error. And the advice that I always give people, it seems to only happen when there are multiple people in the sentence, like you noticed. So I tell people, drop it out. Just have, you know, get rid of Bob. If you're saying Bob and me, get rid of Bob. And then you'll usually be able to see whether it should be I or me in the sentence.
Kathy, thanks for that call. Mignon Fogarty, as always, thanks for joining us. I love having you on.
Thank you. It's always fun. Thanks for having me. Thanks for having me on your show.
Yeah, thank you. Mignon Fogarty, host of the Grammar Girl podcast. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.